Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 21, Celebrate Good Times. Come on, it's a celebration.
The purpose of Short Box Showcase is to talk about topics in comics that fall outside of our respective solo shows.
Except for this episode.
This one's a party, so we are throwing out all of the rules. It's our one-year anniversary!
Yay! Woo! Now, technically speaking, both Uncovering the Bronze Age and Quarterbin Podcast had released episodes in the week before Short Box Showcase 1, but I consider those to be the network's soft open.
The test run, if you will.
It's sort of the test run. So seeing as this show has become the leader of Relatively Geeky, it seems appropriate to consider the first episode of Short Box Showcase number 1 to be the official grand opening of the Relatively Geeky Network.
So it's been a year. A lot of things have changed. This show exists and has the most listeners, most regular release schedule. As you mentioned, the boss of this whole network. It's our bread and butter.
I mean, to be fair, in terms of total downloads, Quarterbin Podcast is still the leader.
And per episode downloads...
What do you mean? Total downloads, I think. Quarterbin Podcast, clearly.
Yeah, yeah.
The fact that there are 31 episodes of the Quarterbin Podcast compared to... Okay, you are carrying the weight of the show.
In sheer listenership, yes. See, this is the thing. Yours...
I like to think of my show as quantity. Your show's as quality.
And you know what?
Wait a minute. I think
that is a fair breakdown. Yours are reliable and steadily coming out and part of the daily routine. Mine are events. You can't have events all the time. You know,
well, if you're Marvel in DC, you can try.
But we are not that cheap or lazy.
I like cheap.
I like lazy.
What's wrong with that?
Oh, we actually kind of are. Anyway.
So a year ago, we were getting ready to launch the network. We had recorded our solo episodes, and we ended up taking a long car trip.
Yes, which we will be taking another of in 3 days or so. It's this whole cyclical thing.
There is an annual cycle, exactly. But on our way from Central Ohio to Eastern North Carolina last year, among the things we did was listen to the two freaks get off your butt and make podcast episodes, which we had already decided to do. We'd each done a solo episode, but we still thought, let's listen to that. There's a lot of good information in that can really help us. And I think all told, those two episodes are probably about 2.5 hours of content.
Something like that,
and it took us 5 or 6 hours to listen to them.
Yes, because every 10 or 15 minutes, it was throwing out an idea. Do you think we could pull that off? Well, I really like the way that goes, but, you know, maybe it would be better for us to do it more like this. And it basically meant there was 5 hours of discussion on how to run a podcast network. That by the time we finally got into the Carolinas, we were so stoked and pumped and ready to record another episode for another podcast with literally 2 hours of preparation time.
That is when Short Box Showcase was born. We were in North Carolina visiting my father, who was in the hospital after a knee replacement surgery. And for those first few days when my dad was still in the hospital, we had a little bit of quiet time in the evening at the house, and that's when we decided, hey, let's record that Short Box Showcase episode number 1.
We gave ourselves about 4 hours to come up with a topic, as we'd been sort of spitballing ideas in the car. By the time we got there, we each sat down, wrote some notes, decided to record, and realized we didn't really have any of the equipment necessary for a 2-person show.
We did have my laptop, which had Audacity, and since I thought I might be recording a couple of episodes, I had my headset mic.
Not conducive to having 2 people talking on them at the same time. And so if you want to go back and look, there is a picture which was posted right before Short Box Showcase number 1 or right after, somewhere in there on the website.
Late July or early August 2013.
One of our second or third blog posts. has the picture of the workaround that we ended up coming up with, which involved the headset mic, a roll of paper towels, and like 5 rubber bands. And it made a shockingly functional stand microphone.
And if you go back and listen to that episode, I think the content is still pretty good. I think we have vastly improved our sound quality.
Yes, getting a microphone actually designed to have more than one person talking at it, and a thing to hold it up that we don't have to rotate back and forth, making this weird scraping noise because we're rolling a paper towel roll back and forth across the table.
So we can both talk into the little teeny tiny microphone.
That's like the size of a dime. It was an experience. Though we have not yet lost a recorded episode file, we, I think, did get in some of our podcaster brownie points in our very first episode of realizing we don't really have a way to do this. We're going to find one anyway. Technical difficulties, episode 1.
Blue snowball microphone, episode 2.
Yes!
Now, Emily, do you know what the traditional gift is for a 21st episode, 1 year anniversary podcast?
No, I have never had one of those. What is it?
Email feedback!
Oh my gosh!
We have mentioned our buddy Noel Thingvall from the movie podcast I Hate Love Remakes and the Super Saturday Short-Lived Showcase blog. He had a few comments on episode 17, the feedback and shooting the breeze episode. This was actually the first episode where we mentioned him, and so this was actually the first one he listened to. I am amused by how small a world the internet can be.
It is delightful and occasionally disturbing. His magnificentness, Trentus Magnus, also commented on that episode and said nice things to us in his typical understated manner.
Anyway, so enraptured was I by the awesomeness of the episode that I realized I don't think I've ever written into any of the relatively geeky shows. Possibly not Quarterbin, and probably not Shortbox Showcase or Uncovering the Bronze Age. And what a crime, you know?
Does sound criminal, now that he mentions it.
I mean, honestly, it wasn't until I started listening to Shortbox Showcase that I realized how badly I wanted a show about ideas more than specific comics. The Shortbox Showcase definitely has a good spot in the podcast marketplace. Anyway, solid show in general, great episode in particular, and it's always a blast listening to the two true professors break it down for the rest of us.
I will take that. I don't even have to get a doctorate or nothing.
You got a promotion.
I know. Well, does that technically make it 3 professors when we had Professor Superman on? Hmm?
Yes.
Excellent.
And Trentus closes with the traditional greeting of his people.
I am going for a bowl of Cocoa Puffs now. Same to you, Trentus. Same to you.
By the way, I was one of many podcasters on the 50th episode of Trentus Magnus Punches Reality, where guests talked about their favorite issues, 50 or 150 or 250, etc., of a comic. No spoilers, but I talked about a great issue involving Dr. Doom, King Arthur, and Tony Stark's lackey, Iron Man.
There is nothing not to love in that.
Our Michael Bailey crossover episodes also generated some feedback. Noel said that he absolutely enjoyed the 3-part examination of the series.
Rich, insightful, entertaining. It says a lot that, despite telling me even more about the book than I'd probably get myself from a read, I still want to go and read it. Well, mission accomplished.
He asked if either of us as Aquaman fans has ever read the Atlantis Chronicles. It's a maxi series exploring the history of Aquaman's people. It's vastly more fantastical and mythic than this realistically grounded series, but also has very richly painted, complex characters set against periods of sweeping change, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. It's sadly never been collected in trade format, much to the dismay of Peter David, who considers it among the best stuff he's ever written.
If I can find some issues of those somewhere, or get scans of them, I would love to check that out. That sounds right up my alley. And I have wanted to check out some of this this Peter David person ever since I heard of, you know, Pad Smash and things like that.
And just to clarify, we are fans of New 52 Aquaman. The pre-52 is pretty hit and miss. Although most people, not all, I'm looking at you, Rob Kelly, really dig the Peter David run.
I'm a big fan of Aquaman's character. It's just the actual stories have not always been awesome.
Do you like Hook Hand, Water Hand, or actual Flesh Hand?
Oh, I dig Hook Hand. How do you take an awesome character and make him awesomer? Hook Hand. That is the answer.
It is hard to argue with that logic.
I'm just saying. Pirates? Cool. Hook-handed pirates? Badass.
Mark Adams from the Mark's Mess podcast also commented on that crossover. The problem is that he titled his email, Can't Get Enough.
Ba-dum-tish!
So, of course, we were very hesitant to actually read the message. But we gathered up our courage and actually clicked open. Just finished listening to the epic crossover with Michael Bailey on the Kent's miniseries. One of the things I like about the Relatively Geeky Network is the inventiveness. Not only does Quarterbin do a unique crossover with In Country covering the same comic on the same day, but then you do a company-wide crossover with Mr. Comic Book Podcaster himself. Your inventiveness makes the network highly entertaining, and if you're enjoying it as much as I am, you're doing it right.
That is awesome to hear. I think the way that we have our show set up, it's a little difficult to have guests on. It was nice having Luke Giaconetti. When he was on, it was basically just a conversation with no flow or talking points or narrative. It was just three people on the internet talking about stuff, which was awesome. But the thing about the way that our show works in a little bit of a behind-the-curtain sense is it takes about a week to put together one of these. It's about 3 days of you and me talking and figuring out some of our talking points, coming up with a vague order of what we want to discuss and when, and trying to get a vague shape, a sort of rough draft of the conversation.
And part of what we're doing in that process is trying to balance talking out enough that we know there's a topic there.
Mm-hmm.
While also saving the good stuff for the show.
Yeah. And it's a balance. As you like to say, that's when we rehearse our ad-libs. It's a little bit difficult then to have a third person on the show because the way that we work is very much in tandem, back and forth of ideas, whenever inspiration strikes, which works because we live in the same house. Really, I can't speak for anyone else, but I doubt that our friends from the internet would appreciate getting 5 or 6 random text messages through Facebook at 2 a.m. when I have a great idea.
I thought Mike Bailey went above and beyond the call of duty.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, moving in with us for five or six days.
And, you know, it was great to have him here. A lot of fun. If he wants his all of his socks that he left here, we are holding those ransom on eBay. So, with the exception of Mr. Comic Book Podcasting, Michael Bailey, and his exceptional dedication,
That's what they're calling it nowadays. the DSM-5 on mental health disorders refers to it as dedication. Interesting.
It's in order to sort of pay our dues, if you will, to other podcasters. Someone invites you to be on their show, that's great. Someone invites me to be on their show, that's great. It's a little harder for us to invite people onto our show unless we do have some sort of very specific topic or structure or something. So finding these sorts of pseudo crossovers as a way to do that instead has seemed to be working pretty well.
Mark also referred to our frequent comments on Babylon 5. Also a personal favorite of his, although he spells favorite with a U, Northern Irish.
Ugh.
He asks if we've ever thought of talking on a Short Box Showcase about the comics that went with the Babylon 5 series, as they, for the most part, added to the growing universe and were not just filler pieces.
If I could get my hands on some, I would love to read them and maybe discuss them. And you may have found a source.
Earlier in the summer, my wife and I visited her family, her father and her brother, and part of my job in going, other than, you know, entertainment, was to help her brother, your uncle, organize his comic book collection. Because you know this, if you're the comic book guy in the family and someone else begins the hobby, mm-hmm. you get called in to do that emergency organization and structure and all of that. So we were going through his comic books, and he is a sci-fi guy, so he has a ton of Star Trek comic books. One long box of generic comic books and one long box of sci-fi comic books. Ton of Star Trek of all publishers and all series. And he had about six of the Babylon 5. And I had heard of them. I had never seen them. They're hard to find. And your uncle had half of the run.
Yes. So there might be a little bit of a reciprocity trading some comics within the family that would enable those to wander through our doorstep at some point. If we've got something to talk about in them, we can talk about them.
I would love it. I would love it.
He also has... It was the actual Kryptonite Nevermore, right? He actually has a copy from like 1971 or whatever. That blew my mind.
Many of us have the first comic we ever bought. You've talked about the mm-hmm. first comic you ever bought. That was the first comic he's ever bought. It has the cover. It is no longer attached to the comic itself. It was a well-read and well-loved 40-plus-year-old comic. But
right.
again, it was a stunner to actually see it in an amateur's collection, shall we say.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's been collecting for a long time,
but
very
the,
hit and miss.
Not
no
in the
structure.
Collector's mentality
exactly.
sense.
So part of my job in visiting was simply to figure out what he has. And unfortunately, he and my father-in-law were both a little too eagle-eyed for me to actually sneak out with either Kryptonite Nevermore or those darn Babylon 5 issues.
Watched you like a hawk.
I tell ya.
So we'll say maybe.
I like the idea. Mark also mentions that both of you entertain me and are part of my weekly listening. I love my podcast listening. Also, I am a dad of two daughters, and it's fun to hear another father with a comic book daughter. My 10-year-old Charlotte loves comic stuff and came with me to the first Belfast Comic-Con to stand in the rain for 2 hours.
Yeah.
You gotta do what you gotta do.
Sometimes.
I think she was a bit overwhelmed by the experience and
yeah.
probably the 2 hours of rain.
It's not helpful.
And ended up as a pure observer as her father dragged her around the stalls and chatted. She also threw up on the way home in the car, which maybe didn't help.
I'm just sensing this is a not good first con experience overall.
I do have great fun reading comics to Charlotte and her 8-year-old sister, and it's hilarious when they make comments on what happens, which reminds me of the Fantasticast or From Crisis to Crisis. A new listener sent quarter bin feedback, but part of it applies here. Manuel Carmona ended his first email with this. I can't seem to find your Facebook page for the podcast and or the podcast network. Maybe you could provide the link so I can follow you there. Thanks.
And this brings up a conundrum. Because at least some of our promos say that there is a Facebook page. There is no Facebook page.
But should there be a Facebook page?
I think... maybe it should. I know that I, for one, purposely did not say anything about a Facebook page because we were still figuring all of that stuff out when we recorded our first episodes and our promos. So I didn't know what we were going to end up with. And I didn't want to mention that because, to me, making a Facebook page to release with your podcast seemed a little bit presumptuous. It's like, yeah, I know that this is going to have 50 to 150 hits. No problem. I'll have a Facebook page because there's going to be so many people listening.
The fear is we set up the Facebook page.
We check it
a month later and have 5 likes.
Yeah.
And one of them's me and one of them's you. And
one of them's Michael Bailey.
We're thinking about
it. Yeah. I think as we try to do some more networking crossover-y things with other people, as we are starting to get more quote-unquote and beloved random listeners that we don't totally know where they came from, aren't members of the podcaster community or frequent emailers that you would actually know from a forum or et cetera, probably would be a good idea. Because even if we ended up with, you know, 50 likes, if they were all podcasters, then it's a little bit like, well, what's the point? I mean, they have our email and they're friends with you. This seems a little redundant, but I think there could be use for it. Coming soon?
I like how positive and certain you are with that statement.
Very.
Well, we appreciate all the feedback, of course. We welcome the feedback. Send it to relativelygeeky@gmail.com. We're going to take a break, play some promos, and when we come back, we're going to celebrate our anniversary
with a wedding.
The Flashbulb Podcast. 3 to 10 minutes of fiction brought to you thrice weekly. From cosmic horrors to fisticuffs, fast cars, and smart mouths, we've got a chill for every spine. Find it all at flashbulb.com or search for it on iTunes.
Tangent, an abrupt change of course.
Tangent, to go off suddenly in another direction or on a different line of thought.
Tangent, a comic event featuring brand new characters with very familiar names.
I'm breaking in, shaping up, then checking out on the prison bus. This is it, the apocalypse. Whoa, I'm waking up, I feel it in my bones. And I don't think my system blows. Welcome to the new age, to the new age. Welcome to the new age, to the new age.
Parallel Lines, the DC Comics Tangent Universe podcast.
Find it bi-weekly on iTunes and at greatkrypton.com.
In the Tangent Universe, you only know the names.
And we're back.
For the anniversary, we decided to look at an annual.
It seemed appropriate.
So we're looking at Legion of Superheroes Annual 2 from 1983. Now, as we mentioned, usually on this show, we talk about comics that fall outside our regular shows. This one, however, is a DC book from the Bronze Age.
That I found in a quarter bin.
So here we are. We thought if we're going to do an anniversary, then an annual made sense. And this is one of our favorites.
It's really good.
You know, you can do a number of things with annuals in general. You can do reprints. That was fairly common in the 60s before, you know, back issues were a thing. You would reprint some of the more important stories from the last couple of years and maybe add another, you know, one new story or something. Or you could do an event.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic Four Annual 2 with the origin of Dr. Doom.
Yes.
For example.
One of the greatest comic books of all time.
And a pretty good episode of the Fantasticast, if I do say so myself.
Well, speaking of the Fantasticast, their coverage of the various FF annuals was the first time I'd even really thought about annuals. Because for me, and I totally get that this mindset is weird now in retrospect, when I was occasionally buying comics when I was like, you know, 14 to 18... I always sort of steered away from annuals because in my mind, I thought that it was going to be more of a conclusion. That I was like, oh, this is like an annual. It's going to be like the big, important wrap-up of everything that's been happening in the comics.
So like the end of that year, the end of that book, the end of that volume.
That's it. It always sort of felt like reading the last couple of chapters, and I actually wouldn't pick them up for that reason. But then once we started going to the quarter bin and picking up whatever happened to strike our fancy, when I first started getting interested in the Legion, you picked me up 2 or 3 annual issues. One of them was this one.
And they're nice because they're fully contained.
That's the thing.
As folks have mentioned in regards to the quarter bins, one of the problems with discount bins is finding that whole story. I think it was on Fire and Water where Shag...
The Irredeemable...
mention that the trick with quarter bins is that in the cheap bin you find issues 1, 3, 5, and 6. and then issues 2 and 4 on eBay for $17 each or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But when you get an annual, you get the full story. Now, by the time you move into the 90s and beyond, that's not as often the case, where annuals become the vehicle for the event of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably another thing that dissuaded you from purchasing annuals.
Whenever I would see banner with Countdown to Mega Crises on Infinite Subuniverses, I was like, nope, I'm done. I'm bored. Don't care. I'm out of here.
I remember that. That was the 1994 annual series, I think.
Yeah. Infinity Mega Ultra Age of Coming Stormdom.
If it had Infinity, it was Marvel. If it had Crisis, it was DC. That's how you could tell them apart.
Yeah. But to be fair, they all left us in Crisis.
But this one is a standalone event book.
And this is definitely the kind of annual I prefer. There was another annual that we were thinking about sort of doing, but it was one of the reprint annuals. And I just am not interested in reprint annuals. Now, that's mostly because of my sort of trade mentality, that most of the stuff I'm interested in picking up, I could probably find in like a Showcase Presents somewhere. You know, most of the major runs of most of the major characters are at least in the process of being collected into some form of trade or collection or big book, even if it's just, you know, the cheap black and white reprint. I don't really, even for 25 cents,
want to buy
old stories. I'm like, what's the point of that?
Right, I gotcha.
And I you know, I get the point, but it's an in retrospect thing that in the 80s or the 70s or the 60s when they started doing this, it's really important because if you didn't get that issue that had that story in it 3 years before, you
lost
will,
to the sands of time.
You will never see it again. You have missed your chance. The boat has sailed. It is riding off into the sunset without you. So I'm a little sad that Andy and Steve have mentioned in coming years of the Fantasticast, after the birth of Franklin Richards, they tend to be reprint annuals. And I'm like, man.
That's a bummer.
That's a bummer because I would want to go and track down a collection of the FF annuals. If I could sort of get the cliff notes of what was going on in the FF and get annuals 1 through 10 in a nice big paperback and have a very short progression of like a decade of Fantastic Four, I would dig that.
This idea of whether annuals count as part of the regular collection or are part of their own numbering system has been a topic on one particular blog. The blog is called the Chasing Amazing blog.
Yes.
And it's a guy who is attempting to collect every issue of Amazing Spider-Man. He is not collecting the annuals.
Okay.
To him, the annuals are not part of the continuous numerical sequence that he's attempting to collect. And to me, the annuals are part of it. So
yeah. Well,
he was on a podcast talking about it. It became, you know, very in a very joking manner about someone who's doing a similar thing, but also collecting the annuals.
Right.
And so between the two of them, they had sort of a humorous battle over whether annuals count in regular continuity or not.
Well, I think story-wise, they clearly do.
Yes.
Because that is where the story progresses. A lot of times taking pretty major steps, as will happen in this particular annual. I can totally see thinking of Amazing and Spectacular and Web of and Annual
as
different
things.
Series.
Yeah, I understand.
In the Spider-Man case, I can totally see that happening because Marvel is infamous for having, like, at least 2 to 5 Spider-Mans.
Continuities
at
the same
time.
Yeah.
Like, there's too much stuff going on for one Spider-Man. Someone has some crazy theory about there's 2 Spider-Mans at all time from, like, 1989 onward.
And you're not even talking the Clone Saga.
No, and it's a crazy hilarious conspiracy theory that somehow
the only way to make the timetable actually work.
It somehow does tie into that I think it's the Ben Reilly from one continuity half and the Spider-Man from the other. And both or either die, and then there's still two of them, and it's interesting, but it is a special kind of continuity nitpicking.
Which is what nerds specialize in. But what we're talking about today...
Yes!
...is Legion of Superheroes Annual Number 2 from 1983, the story, Whatever Gods There Be, a 40-page mega-epic by Paul Levitz, Keith Giffen, and Dave Gibbons.
I am so stoked.
That's a pretty impressive list of creators.
It's not my personal dream team, but they're pretty amazing.
It's not a bad crew.
Not at all.
On Daxam, a Legion team consisting of Dream Girl, Cosmic Boy, Ultra Boy, White Witch, and Star Boy is working to assist the reconstruction after Darkseid reshaped the entire planet to resemble his head. I assume this is the result of a recent event story of some kind. If you think about it, some dictators build statues to their greatness. Darkseid terraforms a planet into a statue for his greatness.
Only seems appropriate.
The team work together beautifully using their powers in conjunction to aid the planet-wide restoration effort. Starboy makes it rain, not in the modern sense of that term, which is not doing Dream Girl's hair any good. This is important because they're running late for the wedding of Karate Kid and Queen Projectra, formerly the Legionnaire known as Princess Projectra, and must leave Daxam for the wedding on Orando. Meanwhile, preparations are underway for the royal wedding, making this the busiest time the Orando spaceport has ever had. Legionnaires have begun to arrive, with Lightning Lad and Saturn Girl mysteriously keeping a secret, so they don't take the focus away from the happy couple. Timberwolf, Dawnstar, Block, Invisible Kid, Phantom Girl, and Shadow Lass arrive, followed by Wildfire, Colossal Boy, Shrinking Violet, Mon-El, Sunboy, Brainiac 5, Supergirl, and the 1972 Miami Dolphins. Karate Kid invites the arrivees to a big banquet. Get it while it's hot and before the Fatal Five or Darkseid decide to crash the party.
The words are greeted with laughter, but there's a chill behind them despite the humor. For all too often, the Legion's happiest days have been interrupted just that way.
As Dream Girl's team, or the Dream Team, arrive at Orando, they are caught in the time wake of Superboy arriving from the 20th century. Superboy tries to reassure himself that nothing can spoil this day, unlike past Legion weddings.
This time, no paranoia. Nothing can go wrong with this wedding day. Superboy!
You naive, troublemaking time traveler, you.
Causing destruction everywhere you go.
Now let's talk about what we've got here so far. We're going to do this Fantastic-ass style.
Yes! Because
we'll cover 10 pages or so at a time.
Yes, because we need to rip off somebody new for a change.
Exactly. First of all, I love the fact that the Legionnaires were actually working together, using their different powers to accomplish this terraforming task. Often in comic books you see the teamwork is usually each character doing their own thing individually.
This is one of the things that I love about the Legion, is that they are a legit team. That if you take any of the Legionnaires on their own, their power set is not that impressive, especially given the big heavy hitters of the DC Universe. You've got your Supermans, you've got your Green Lanterns, you got your Wonder Womans, who can like bench press cars, move planets, fly through space unassisted. Like, there is a lot of impressive stuff that they can do.
Now, Superboy can fly through time so quickly that he can knock a spaceship out of its course. Well, we'll get to that in the next section.
We'll get to that. You've got Lightning Lad. He shoots lightning. That's impressive. But he can't fly, doesn't have any sort of vision powers, and he's really squishy. D&D term for you. On a whole, the Legionnaires are a little less powerful than a lot of solo heroes, which is good because there's like 100 of them. So if you have 14 teenagers with superpowers, regardless of how middle to vaguely level impressive they can be, there's 14 of them. They're going to get in some hits on you.
Right.
Doesn't matter who you are.
Now, you mentioned teenagers
mm-hmm.
in regards to the Legion. And I think we may be at the point here in this version where we're entering adulthood, obviously.
Yes.
There have been marriages. This is a wedding ceremony that mm-hmm. we're focusing on in this issue.
We're sort of in the second version of the Legion.
The young adult starting to grow up mm-hmm. a little bit version.
Well, even as they will explain a little later, is that whenever Legionnaires get married, they resign from active duty. And so far, there have been at least 3 weddings, this one included. Lightning Lad and Saturn Girl, and Bouncing Boy and Duo Damsel. That those 4 have already gotten married, set up adult lives, resigned from the Legion, and moved on. And now they still have
their reserve status.
Yeah, they have reserve status that if there's an emergency, they can get called back in, but they're not going to be on active duty.
Now, does the hierarchy go active, reserve, substitute? Or
and then,
active, substitute, reserve?
No. Active, reserve, substitute, substitute in training. Not good enough to be on the substitute Legion. Rao, help us all!
Editor's note, Quarterbin Podcast, Episode 2.
Yes, this is almost sort of a second incarnation of the Legion, that 2 of the 3 founders and 2 of the early introduced secondary Legion characters, Duo Damsel and Triplicate Girl, and Bouncing Boy, they've all moved on and are, like, getting jobs, like adults.
So sort of somewhere between high school graduate, college graduate, young adult, sort of.
So when the Legion was first created, they were all sort of 14 to 15, like Superboy.
I mean, it was the superhero club.
Exactly.
Is in essence what the concept was.
Exactly. That they were all high schoolers, like middle schoolers even. And in this, most of the Legion is between the ages of like 18 and 25. That's actually something I really appreciate. When we talked about sidekicks, we mentioned the Legion right. a little bit. Part of why I love the Legion is because they are legit respected heroes in their own rights.
Differentiating them from the Teen Titans, for example, which
right.
was the sidekicks club.
Right. That, you know, a 15-year-old Saturn Girl could walk into, I don't know, whatever it is, the League of Non-Aligned Worlds, the Alliance
CH, United Planets.
The Space EU. That she could walk into a meeting and everyone would listen to her, even though she was 15, because she held a legit semi-military political position. She was important. Speedy was a side character going off and having adventures.
So just a different dynamic. It's a different type of story being
right.
told there.
And, you know, in the 60s, it was just shenanigans and super dickery. That's all it was. Moving in more into the 70s, the 80s, and then my personal favorite version of the Legion, which is the 2000 version, where they are very much a paramilitary, Occupy Wall Street sort of youth movement organization. I like the idea of them being taken seriously. Not just taking themselves seriously, but actually having some weight with older adults. That they do note that R.J. Brand, who's sort of the Legion organizer by this point, the one who put the club together, a lot of the politicians they run into, heads of the science police,
right.
they're all in their 40s to 50s, and they look different, even from the young adult heroes that we get here.
Comparing the original incarnations, let's say the 15-year-olds who made up the Legion at first, to now the 22 to 25-year-olds who are making up this particular version of the Legion, at what point do girl, boy, lad stop being appropriate for your name?
I would say sometime between turning 18 and growing a lumberjack beard. Because Star Boy looks like a Mountie.
He is a man, baby.
A man. And it was hilarious. Because on the one page, You see at the bottom, all right, Starboy, give us a hand. And on the next one, there's just this giant blonde dude with a massive biblical proportion beard. And I thought, that is no boy.
Part of the problem is that previous stories have linked the evil versions of the Legion into sort of the natural names. So Saturn Queen is a villain, Lightning Lord.
Such a cool name!
Cosmic King.
Such a cool name! Lightning Lord, Master of Electricity. That is the coolest title.
But since he's a bad guy, we're still stuck with Lightning Boy.
Which is really unfortunate. And something that I'm a little sad doesn't get brought up more often in 80s Legion, because even in 60s Legion, when Superman would interact with the Legion, he was interacting with Cosmic Man, Lightning Man, and Saturn Woman. Triplicate Woman, Bouncing Man, which is still not a dignified name, but there's only so much you can do.
I do think that some of the characters who were created and introduced into the Legion later were probably purposely named more generic things. Here we've already had White Witch.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an age-specific name, obviously. Wildfire and Dawnstar and those other block. There are other examples of names that don't have that particular naming conventions. But
right.
I do think that is a bit of a problem.
And on the other side, that, of course, in the 90s version, they were like, those names are silly. We need them
right.
to be cool and hip and edgy. Which the Legion never is, never will be.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of nerds hanging out in spandex costumes. And the best Legion stories are the ones that sort of admit that they're fanboys. Again, something I love in the 2000 version, that they're all basically cosplayers. They're steampunks. They really like the fashions of the early 2000s. So now in the early 3000s, they go around dressed like heroes from the 21st century. That's cool. And because of that, they're sort of hipster-ishly aware that their names are silly and intentionally choose silly names, but they just totally own it. In the 90s, they did not. They were like, nope. Too silly. We've got to reboot it. We've got to change the names. Lightning Lad was Livewire, and Cosmic Boy was like...
I don't even want to know what Karate Kid would have been.
It was just...
Kick Puncher Man.
I also don't like that, where they're just like, nope, the names are silly. We need to not address them and just like give them new names, because that was also really silly. There was a speedster who was XS. And I was like, oh, really, guys? Really?
So maybe they were cosplaying Image?
Yeah.
Liefeld cosplayers?
So I don't think either of those are the right way to go. It's something I wish was happening a little bit more by this point of when they are in their early 20s, of them starting to refer to themselves as man, woman, or choosing a new name for their adult identity. It's something that I think that should happen most of the time. I mean, you have Robin to Nightwing. Once puberty is done, you kind of pick a new name. Because if you pick your name...
Speedy to Arsenal.
Yeah, because if you're 15, you come up with the awesomest superhero name ever. You are not going to want to be stuck with it when you are 25.
Think of your fashion choices and hairstyle at age 15.
Yeah.
You did not want that at 25.
Nope. Let's just say 15-year-old kids, not the most astute or aware of long-term implications and consequences.
But they know awesome.
But they do know awesome. They know extreme.
Our story continues.
The Dream Team has been swept back in time to Earth's past, as verified by Cosmic Boy's ability to read the magnetic waves of the planet. Ultra Boy surveys it and deduces that the year is approximately 200 BC. He tries to break through the time barrier like Superboy or Mon-El, but his one power at a time limit means he can't go fast enough to break the time barrier and avoid incineration. Suddenly, they are attacked by Greek soldiers, and after incapacitating them, decide to go to a nearby stone city that Dream Girl has had a vision of. On the way, Dream Girl offers Starboy the position of deputy leader, but before he answers, they arrive in the city, and the crowd, awed by their appearance and descent from the sky, direct them to a temple, where things do not go great.
Presumptuous ones, striding through our temple, boasting of your petty powers, bow before us, before the true power of the gods.
Back at Legion HQ, Duo Damsel and Bouncing Boy regret that they had to stay behind and watch the wedding via long-distance internet TV. Chameleon Boy and RJ Brand join them, fresh off a trip from Durla to restore Cam's shape-changing abilities. They notice that Dream Girl's team has vanished. Chameleon Boy contacts Dawnstar, who checks for their trail. They have disappeared with no trace, but nobody feels too worried. They all assume that Dream Girl is just treating herself to some pre-wedding pampering. Everyone continues in the festivities, including Karate Kid tossing around some of his buddies in a fighting ring. Because of course. Saturn Girl sums up the scenario.
I'm sure they must have just made a harmless detour. Can't she read minds? Shouldn't she know?
Well, you know,
they have disappeared 3,200 years ago. So,
that's the thing. You know, she's a mind reader. She's not a psychic. There is a difference.
Is
the
true.
Psychic is in the past. Not helpful.
That is true.
Before we go any further, are we going to talk fashion?
We do have to talk fashion, because it's the 80s, and it's the Legion.
And this would be the era that if you have ever heard of anyone refer to the Disco Legion, this is it. Because, oh my gosh, all of these people are ready to go clubbing, like right now.
If the irredeemable Shag were indeed here, you know what he'd say? Dream Girl is hot.
He's not wrong. She is rocking that outfit. You know, since we've made some mention of her hair is pretty amazing. It's like all defying gravity and super 80s chic, but not ridiculous.
It's actually working.
It's actually working really, really well for her.
You have to talk about Karate Kid.
Okay, so have we decided that Karate Kid has a better wedding dress than his bride?
It is quite an awesome gown. It certainly takes the Dick Grayson collar to literally new heights.
Oh my god, it is amazing. Like, imagine the biggest Dracula collar that you can.
Double it,
and like add pointy bits, because my god, is that amazing.
It's multiple colors.
I've got to say, again, I would wear that. It's so insane that it's amazing. Gold and black brocade and red dragon belt and giant Dracula collar with, like, bits holding it together that are, like, right on his man boobs. It's kind of amazing.
Now, there have been multiple versions of Supergirl's outfit throughout the decades. I kind of liked parts of this version of Supergirl's costume. You were not so keen on it.
This, I have to say, is my least favorite. I have seen her in many, many versions of her costume, and I like this one, I'm pretty sure, the absolute least. Red Lantern Supergirl included. I really am digging it.
The bottom half is not great. The granny panties.
Okay, here's a fun fact for people out there. You already know that I'm a costumer, but I am actually a bit of a practiced tailor. Like, I know how to make clothes. I know how to cut them, and I know how to make them fit you, and I know what does not work, and literally every part of that is wrong.
But what I liked about it...
low-cut V, long granny panties, poofy sleeves, I dislike basically all of it.
I like the little S logo on one side.
That I do agree with. It's almost sort of like a...
It's like a crest almost,
yeah,
or
like,
something.
Almost like a golf shirt crest or something. Where there's just right there on the side, and it's subtle. links her to the super family, but isn't just bam. That is literally the only thing about it that I find in any way attractive. It's a bad outfit, guys. It's a really bad outfit.
And this is probably Timberwolf's most unfortunate look as well. Yeah. Sort of an orangey brown.
And purple.
And a purple, and it's color blocked in an odd way.
And again, here's an unfortunate bit of them getting older, is that when he designed it, it probably looked great. Now he's got about 4 inches of chest hair poking out the top of the collar. And it is, in a word, unfortunate. I think the shortest straws in Legion outfits have been drawn by those two. Everybody else has definitely stepped up their game for the wedding.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Superboy.
Mm-hmm.
Carrying on Superman's tradition of being a total nuisance.
And just rampantly accidentally destructive.
So he just basically burst through the time stream, sending the 5 members of the Dream Team back to ancient Greece. Doesn't notice. And I love the fact that nobody seems all that worried, because even though Dream Girl
is the leader,
they elected her, because if it's the Legion, there is bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm. And there is so much red tape.
Does not seem to be a lot of respect for her leadership. The assumption is, yes, she totally simply disappeared off the face of the earth.
To go to the spa.
To go to the space spa somewhere.
Space supercuts. I mean, get a perm. A space just, perm.
Is that her normal expected behavior? And yet she won the election. So I guess the boys and the lads do outweigh the lasses and the girls and voted for because a shag would say.
She's hot.
But just not a lot of respect for her. I do like Ultra Boy and the way his power limitation worked in this segment.
Ultra Boy is, it's hard to say, you know, favorite Legionnaire because there's so many of them. But Ultra Boy is probably up there in my top 5. I really like Ultra Boy, if only because the way his powers works is that he has all the same powers as Superman. He can do anything that Superman can, but only one at a time. Which then puts, I think, a much more reasonable limit on it, rather than, say, kryptonite.
Or magic.
Yeah. Which then means that Superman must always run into people who have kryptonite or can use magic. Because
ooh, magic kryptonite.
Pink kryptonite?
That would be awesome.
So with Superman, it kind of feels contrived for how you're putting limits on his powers. Even in the Denny O'Neil kryptonite Nevermore, it's really silly.
But this seems, in a comic book setting, to be more realistic? Or more reasonable, perhaps?
And definitely easier to write. Because we have the ability to fly through time, which is insane. But they establish that that's a thing they can do. And then Ultra Boy tries it. Usually when he goes through time, he becomes super invulnerable and has Superman carry him. Then he's only using one power, and he can move through time. But he cannot go fast enough to break through time and avoid being burnt to a cinder by friction at the same time. So that was an awesome way to explain how they're stuck in the past, but also have a very powerful member of the team to help get them out of scrapes along the way.
Now, there's a cool bit of continuity in here, because Sunboy, he's drawn with sort of a weird thing on his jaw. It's very subtle, and his drawings themselves are very small. He's not a major part of the action, but it's something that they reference later on. And I just think just the ability of keeping 15, 20, 25 character stories in the air at the same time.
And that's the thing.
Is really impressive.
If you think about the number of people that they actually make references to what's going on, you've got Timberwolf, Karate Kid, Princess Projectra, and Saturn Girl. And that's just sort of the main team. And then, of course, recurring references to the fact that Dream Girl has recently been elected as the leader.
Chameleon Boy has lost his powers.
The fact that Bouncing Boy and Duo Damsel are serving as the reserves, and so they get called in for monitor duty. That's nine. That's nine characters that you're keeping their emotional or historical, romantic, recent events separate and dealt with.
Right.
It's a really impressive bit of writing. And before we get too much further away from talking about fashion, I do want to point out that White Witch has my single favorite outfit of the Legion. It is awesome because it's an off-the-shoulder dress, but more of an over tunic with a single pant and boot and shirt underneath it. And it looks awesome.
And it's all white, which is her shtick. Her skin's white, her hair's white, her costume's white. But the monochrome nature of her and the costume,
it totally works.
Yeah, it does not mean that it's boring. That within those really tight restrictions, someone managed to design a pretty cool looking costume.
Like, it's one that I'm sticking on my longer list of cosplay. I want to build that outfit because it looks so cool. And it does a good job of looking both space agey and mystical, which right. is kind of her thing, that it's got the big long princess sleeves and the exposed neck and shoulders that you would see on like a Game of Thrones gown. But then it's got the built-in thigh-high boot spandex pant.
Long sleeve.
It's just really cool. I really, 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 really like it. And I had never met this character until this moment. And at that moment, I was like, you are one of my new favorites. I love you.
All right, back to the story. Dream Girl is the first Legionnaire to awaken in the presence of the Greek gods and tries to apologize for their intrusion. Starboy is having none of this apologizing stuff, instead insulting the gods.
Good plan.
Zeus puts everyone to sleep using the mists of Morpheus, except Dream Girl. Zeus takes a walk with her, because she's hot, and he's Zeus. The Big Z divulges that they are from another planet, as she and her comrades are. He is pompous and certain in his power, even threatening to kill the Legionnaires if they try to reveal these facts, because he's Zeus. Dream Girl uses her powers to see the near future for Zeus's homeworld, and discovers that Zeus and the other Greek gods are actually from Durla, Chameleon Boy's world. Dawnstar gets word back to Chameleon Boy that she cannot pick up the trail of the missing Legionnaires, so Cam calls in the Time Institute to look for the Legionnaires through the time barrier. Back in ancient Greece, the other four Legionnaires are held in super electronic glass cases that Cosmic Boy manages to magnetically discombobulate. Their escape, however, draws the attention of the Olympians.
Now, mortals, you shall learn the true folly of defying your gods.
So, what we have here is the ancient alien astronaut theory.
Which is something that I really dig in DC Comics, because there are aliens with time travel.
It could be.
This is perfectly logical. Especially in a Legion story. Something like this could also happen in like a Superboy story or maybe like a Green Lantern or something like that, where someone tries to pass themselves off as a god, is actually an alien, you know? I totally dig that. And in this case in particular, I really like the way that the alien astronauts are portrayed, because even though they're aliens and space travelers, they do not have time travel.
Right.
And Zeus at one point very specifically states, I am too much of a scientist to believe in this nonsense. Meaning, when Dream Girl says, yeah, we're from the future. He's like, don't try to con a con artist. Like, I know what you're doing. You don't need to say you're from the future. I already know you're aliens. She's like, you're not listening at all. I'm from 3,000 years in the future. And he's like, yeah, whatever.
To be fair, he is Zeus and she's hot.
So. Yeah, exactly. So he's like, eh, yeah, you can say whatever crazy things you want, crazy girl.
The only technical minor problem with this is that there are actual real Greek gods in the DC universe.
I was really hoping that at the end it would turn into a Wonder Woman crossover, and Zeus would show up and pimp slap fake Zeus, that would have been awesome to me.
This is one of the things I actually like about the DCU of this era, is that there are multiple Greek pantheons. There are multiple Atlantises.
Yeah, there's like four, aren't they? There's a ton.
That does not bother me in the
at
least.
All.
As long as the...
There's Atlantic East, Atlantic West, and New Atlantis.
Exactly. I mean, you just get the feeling that Lori Lamaris, for example, has never heard of Aquaman,
mm-mm,
and vice versa.
Yeah. Certainly never met.
Exactly. Because they're from different Atlantises. And to me, that's okay.
Yeah.
You don't have to tie everything.
Now, there was a little bit of a powers question, because earlier in the story, they established what Derlins can do, is that they can shapeshift. Which did confuse me then a little bit in retrospect, when Zeus just, like, magically throws sleepy mist at their faces.
Well,
where did that come from?
They do obviously have some electrical sources. I mean, they're keeping them in super modern 20th century, you know, glass tubes with electronics and so on. So there must have been some sort of gas, some sort of sleeping chemical or gas, I guess.
Yeah.
But... And, it's a fair point.
And they do point out that Zeus has these giant braces on his arms. And they do establish at one point that they are sort of scientific-y.
Right.
Because at one point he's pushing buttons on one of them. And one of the other legionnaires says, get out of his way, he's going to throw lightning. I kind of dug that. And Zeus, I think, was the best sort of thought through for this idea. Like, what can Zeus do? He turns into various kinds of animals and hits on ladies.
That a Derlin can do.
And he throws lightning.
And that a,
that
science
a scientist
dude
could
do.
Right. So Zeus, I definitely think, works the best. I almost kind of wish they established that there's 15 Greek gods. I kind of wish it had just been Zeus, Hera, Poseidon, Hephaestus. That it was a smaller group, because really Hephaestus, Hera, and Zeus are the only ones, or it's Aphrodite actually, who's got a siren-y, mind control-y something or other going on. You only really get to know three of them as characters, so I almost wish it had been a smaller group rather than having all of these Greek gods, but only four of them are actually useful, and you only see the other ones in one big scene at the beginning when they're revealed, and one big scene when they're all running away.
But a couple of things there. First of all, it's an annual. And you've already got 25-plus legionnaires.
So why not?
Why not throw in 15 members of the Greek pantheon? You've got Giffen and Gibbons. They can handle it.
Yeah, that is true.
I mean,
they can totally handle it.
These are full, full panels.
Oh my gosh, yes. Each one does that thing that comic book panels should do of establishing multiple things happening at the same time in every page and panel. There are no boring panels and there are no fat to be trimmed.
Right, there's no throwaway, no wasted. Yep.
No wasted space. Every panel is establishing something about the situation or progressing the story, providing a character moment, setting up something for later in the story. And it's really well handled.
Now, back in the 30th century, they are trying to figure out what happened. So they send Dawnstar out.
We already talked about age and the Legion, and to a certain degree, gender in the Legion. That the Legion has actually always been pretty good about gender stuff. The first leader was a dude, but Saturn Girl was elected leader in, like, 1966.
And she was leader for quite some time.
She was leader
for, like, eight years. Though, to be fair, she does have mind control powers. So I think once she's elected leader, she's a little like Dr. Doom, you know, one election is enough when it comes to me. We really don't need to repeat that again. She does have, I'm going to make you think what I want you to think, girl. So...
Do what I want, girl. So... But they've never been super weird about that. Sometimes they've been randomly weird and just decide in one story, Saturn Girl needs to not be in this story or she'll stop the problem at page six. So Saturn Girl, you have to stay behind and make cookies. But
yeah, I mean, you do have the problem with when you have people with that many powers. you have to make sure the people with the right powers are not on the mission.
Mm-hmm. Or they'll just solve everything and you've got 12 blank pages. So I totally get why that would happen, but they've actually always been pretty good about gender. The Legion has a iffier relationship with race. Infamously, Pharaohlad was a character who was introduced pretty early on, like the 68 or something, and he was a character who was in basically very Iron Man style, a full metal suit. You couldn't see anything of his actual skin. And famously, the creator wanted to reveal in the fifth or sixth story that Pharaohlad was in that he was black. And he was going to be the first black member of the team. And DC was like, nope, can't do that. You're going to alienate people and it's going to throw off our groove and you can't do that. So the guy was like, okay, screw it. I'm killing him instead. Things have gotten better since then. Karate Kid in this issue is not actually yellow, which is the way he's covered
sometimes.
1982 story that I will be talking about at some point because it has my favorite panel of all Legion Comicsdom. Dad knows what it is.
That sounds like an issue from the Bronze Age that needs to be uncovered at some point.
Oh, it is amazing.
But
since then, those sorts of race relations have gotten better. Those issues have been handled with more increasing sensitivity and awareness. And
you just want subtlety. You just want...
Yeah. Yes. Now,
Dawnstar.
I love her character. I adore her. And as far as hottest member of the Legion, Dawnstar. Calling it right now. She looks like Hawk Girl cosplaying Pocahontas. What is not to love? I ask you.
We'll have to run that one by Shag.
But here's the problem. I love her as a character. She is sweet and wonderful and awesome. Her power is super tracking.
No, but it's respectful because that's what, you know, those people do. It's what those... Oh, I see your point.
And it's not bad. I'm not decrying racism, Zermagod. But it is just a little, 1980s, you were trying. You were trying really hard. It was basically the same thing when they introduced Karate Kid. His power is martial arts, and we are going to color him actual, like, daisy and dandelion yellow. But you were trying. And this is that, but less so. It's just, it just made me sort of sigh a little bit and go, oh, right, because it was the 80s and that's how that rolled. But I do love her.
And of course, those characters were introduced in the 70s when they were actively attempting, with good intentions,
yes,
to broaden those sorts of characterizations, mm-hmm, and membership in the Legion, etc.
Thoroughly approve of, absolutely appreciate. I love Karate Kid. I love Dawnstar.
They're just moments of awkward occasionally.
There are just those moments where you're like, wow, this is a great character. And then you get just a little reminder of, oh, right. This
is 30 plus years old.
A different time. A different time.
They were set in their ways back then.
Yes. But trying. And I appreciate the effort.
Absolutely.
It's A for effort, C minus for execution.
In retrospect.
In retrospect, yes. Back to the story. The battle against the gods goes fairly well for the Legionnaires by using teamwork to help each other as they get into trouble, delivering consequences to the gods as needed. Ultra Boy declares that this side trip may even turn out to be fun, if they can get back home from it. Zeus directs Hermes to launch their escape vehicle, declaring that they have finished the work they came to Earth for. The Durlins change shape into teeny tiny, super cute animals and flee. The top dome of the temple rockets off into space, and the Legionnaires appear to be stranded. But Chameleon Boy arrives to their rescue, as once he knew to look for them in time, it was pretty easy to track them down with the help of the Time Institute. Back on Orando, with everybody present who is supposed to be present, Karate Kid and Queen Projectra are wed. And surprisingly for a comic book wedding, it goes off without a hitch. Well, they're getting hitched And
so there was a hitch. It just went off without a hitch. They got hitched.
Right. Good things happen.
And then we get the epilogue, which will then lead us then into what the following issues would be, where Element Lad and Science Police Officer Siobhan Aaron arrive just as the ceremony is ending, after confirming that one of the Legionnaires there is actually an imposter.
Dun, oh, dun, dun, dun!
As someone who was reading Legion in the mid to late 70s and through the 80s, the Time Institute and Siobhan of the Science Police were main secondary characters, and I loved their involvement here. I loved all the time stuff in the Legion. Between Time Trapper as one of the main villains, the Time Institute, I really dug that aspect of Legion storytelling of this time.
And I love Siobhan. Like, the fact that there is a fully legit Irish person on the Science Police, I think is kind of cool.
So let me get this straight. Vaguely Native American tracker is a problem. Irish beat cop is okay in your mind?
We're like 200 further years removed from that. It's cool now. But she's ginger and has green eyes, and her name is Siobhan Aaron.
She's pretty awesome.
Let me just say, I appreciate diversity of all kinds, including that of nationality. And the reason I love Dawnstar is that she is more than her stereotype.
Yes.
She just is also her stereotype.
Fair enough. Now, before we go back, I still want to talk about this last page for a second. What do we think of Element Lad's tight blonde afro cut sort of thing?
Blonde fro?
His blonde fro?
Really so very 80s. So very awesome. It is 80s cool.
Again, I love the ending just because in the past, I love the fight, the teamwork. Dream Girl shown she has some physical skills to toss Big Zeus around in addition to just having those limited powers. I actually like, we didn't talk about White Witch here.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about her costume. But I liked her powers in that even though they're magic-based, they take some level of preparation. And so when she was transported back to the past, she had not prepared the proper spells. You almost get the sense that this is either a recipe or there's some level of studying involved or something. But she had not prepared the types of spells that would have helped them. She had prepared sort of a firework spell that she was going to use at the end of the wedding. And she was able to actually to use that in this story to blind the Durlins, the Greek gods. But I really like that take on magic.
Mm-hmm. And it was something that as I was reading it, I was like, this is very D&D. Because, just so you know, the way magic works in D&D is that you have to declare in advance what spells you're going to use that day. Because you tend to know a whole ton, but you can only use maybe 3, 4, 5 of them at a time. So you have to think, okay, what sort of things are we going to be getting into? Okay, well, we're going to be searching in this dark cavern. I should prepare light spells and fire spells. So I really dug that idea that, yes, it's magic, but it's not a cop-out. It's actually not always a problem solver. It's actually a conflict creator. I was all about that. Basically, what I'm saying is I love White Witch. This is, I think, the only issue that I own that has her in it.
Once the Time Institute and Chameleon Boy rescue them from the past, at that point you have 2 or 3 pages of some of the interpersonal relations. And again, I think that's one of the strengths of the Legion in general, is, as we were talking about before, not just the number of dating and then marriage situations, but the number of just different types of relationships. Timberwolf, there's some jealousy there. There's been some heartbreak in the past. It is a wedding, so you do have those Legionnaires who are couples, are attending as couples, so you get all of that. You do get, again, this notion of Saturn Girl and Lightning Lad having a secret, which is clearly that she's pregnant. Again, I don't know if I caught that when I was reading it at age 17 or 18, or whether that was a big reveal a few issues later. I also love the fact that Supergirl and Brainiac 5 are talking about, well, just before they got married, they sent in their retirement papers, because in the Legion,
it's all about the paperwork, baby.
It is all about the bureaucracy and the paperwork. There's a point earlier on where Dream Girl appoints a temporary assistant leader, which is evidently you have to do that. I'm surprised there were only five of them in the past that even constituted a quorum based on Robert's Rules of Orders, although... do you take the Robert Rule of Orders of 200 BC?
See, I think what it probably counts is quorum of legionnaires in that time period.
Ah, exactly. See, it makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a recess appointment that probably has to later be approved at the next new business meeting of the Legion.
It's all about the bureaucracy.
But I love, again, all of the relationships. There are lots of couples. There's some broken hearts. I love that aspect of it. And there's a little aspect of teen young adult romance, but it's not done in the CW way.
No, thank goodness. And we now, with a closer look at Sunboy, can see what the crap is going on with his jaw. It's actually a cybernetic brace because he's got a broken jaw. But... I'm just saying, still getting hit on by the ladies. They are not turned off at all.
Well, you know, he is. In the interest of just being fair in our gender politics, We have discussed the hottest Legionnaire. Phantom Girl is actually a candidate as well. But as far as the fellas go, I don't know.
It's probably...
Mon-El?
Probably a Mon-El and... and Sunboy toss up with, you know, Lightning Lads getting it done.
I know most of our listeners are yelling, Bouncing Boy, Bouncing Boy, but...
He managed to get three hot wives. How did that even... Well, three hot girlfriends, two hot wives.
It works. Now, here's the question. Now, we've been struggling with marriage for centuries here in terms of polygamy versus age of... legal marriage, and now obviously gay marriage, and the other aspects of defining of marriage. Evidently, things have progressed far enough 1,000 years from now that Bouncing Boy is able to marry both Duo Damsel and Duo Damsel.
Yeah, so progress marches on.
I'm not exactly sure what that counts as. Something, but it works.
Clonogamy is a thing.
Now, our podcasting colleagues.
Yes.
The Super Future Friends.
Yes.
They are madly in love with Brainiac 5. So, I don't think he counts as that one of the hottest.
Especially not in this version where he is, I'm just going to say this now, there is a body type difference between a 16-year-old nerd and a 22-year-old nerd. Saying he's put on like 35 pounds. So
he's moving towards Bouncing Boy territory.
Maybe he'll get two hot wives. Who knows?
I actually do like the fact that most of these characters do not look like kids. Mm. They do not look like teenagers. And it's tricky. And Superboy does not look like Superman.
No.
But he doesn't look 15 either.
No.
And that is a hard thing to do.
He honestly is one of the younger looking Legionnaires, but right. I would say I look at him at 17, Everyone else is sort of 19 to 22.
Yeah.
But none of them look 30, none of them look 5, right. Or 12, you know? Good job. Basically what we're saying is, good job, artist. Because this is a gorgeous book, especially that final, the final two-page splash page for the wedding and the kiss. And all of the courtiers and the people in attendance and the Legion, and there's trumpeters and sunset and bright, beautiful lights, and it's really nice.
And even though they're halfway across the galaxy, Bouncing Boy, Duo Damsel, and RJ Brand, they are appearing as floating heads because Skype has gotten that much better in the next 1,000 years.
Yeah, holo Skype. They're holo Skyping into the wedding.
But I love this issue. And now we were making fun a little bit of Queen Projecta's wedding gown, because compared to Karate Kid's, it's nowhere near as fancy. But we have one sort of overhead shot of them walking down the aisle. And to be fair, she does have about a 30-foot train. So that does rock pretty well.
Oh, yeah. As I'm just saying, best dressed couple right there.
That is actually a pretty impressive. I mean, her costume is fairly monochromatic. It's a nice, rich, pinky type of purple. But it looks good. I like her hair.
She's got a little circlet. And very cute.
And he has got a collar that is defying more types of gravity in this final kiss.
It's defying all the physics. Just wow. But it is great. This whole issue is great.
So, for our anniversary, we did a special annual issue. Maybe we can make it an annual tradition.
Ah.
And next year, cover another annual.
I like this idea.
The nice thing about annuals is that between DC and Marvel, they put it about 35 a year.
Yeah.
So, it won't be that hard to find a good one. Now, we did shout out individually to Mike Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
And to the irredeemable Shag earlier, did want to point out that in a recent episode of Views from the Long Box, episode 188, they actually spent a couple hours talking about the entire history of the Legion. We just spent about an hour talking about one issue.
Yeah.
So they gave the big, broad overview. And we dug deep into the details of
this issue. We probably did a lot more fashion criticism than they did, I'm assuming. Well, I mean, it's Shag, so maybe not.
Yeah, I don't think that's technically fashion criticism, what he's doing.
No.
That's
something else.
That's something else. Well, we do want to thank our listeners who have been with us for this year. We totally appreciate it. You guys are awesome.
Mm-hmm.
The feedbacks, the downloads, the comments, the tweets, the Facebooks. We appreciate all of it. We've had very nice things said about the show over the last year.
From many different people, some of which we didn't even know.
And that has helped us really enjoy doing this show.
Yeah.
Yet some of these conversations we would have anyway, but the depth and the regularity is helped by recording them a couple times a month.
Yep.
So I have very much enjoyed it. I've enjoyed chatting with you for the last year, Em.
As have I.
Let's do it for at least one more year.
Fingers crossed.
Maybe longer.
If you have anything that you would like to contribute to our show, you can email us at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. If you just want to say hi, if you have an issue you want us to talk about, a concept, any sort of feedback is appreciated. You can check out our actual website where we post the links to the episodes as well as occasional additional pictures and funny stuff and news about what's going on in our lives every now and then at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. Check us out in iTunes, and soon you can find us on Facebook too.
Probably.
Maybe.
And remember, as always, when it comes to discussing these comics, we're not experts.
We're just family.
Thanks for listening.
Take care, guys.